Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today.
What's the first brand you remember making an impact on you as a young boy growing up in this town outside Milan?
I discovered just recently most of my notebooks at school from 6 to 13 were Pepsi branded.
Oh, my. Oh.
And then, no clue, I still have them here. Geography, history, where you would write everything, I still have them. And where Pepsi, my mother would buy them in bulk, and I totally forgot. And then I found them because, thank God, my mom conserved, you know, saved everything. And many of them were Pepsi. I was like, oh, what a coincidence.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. My guest today in the CMO podcast is Mauro Porcini, the SVP and chief design officer of PepsiCo, the $91 billion company by revenue. Pepsi's founding dates back to 1893 with the invention of Pepsi Cola in a small town in North Carolina. In 1965, Pepsi combined with Frito-Lay to become PepsiCo and is now among the most admired food and beverage companies in the world, with brands that range from Cheetos to Mountain Dew to Gatorade to SodaStream to Quaker. My guest Mauro is the first chief design officer we have had on the show. And speaking of firsts, Mauro was the first ever global chief design officer at 3M, where he spent 10 years, and PepsiCo, where he has been thriving for the past 12 years. Mauro was born and raised outside Milan, Italy, studied at the National College of Art and Design, and earned a master's at the Politecnico di Milano. Mauro is an evangelist for human-centric design, just Google him, and he has a capacity and energy level that is unrivaled. This is my conversation with one of the top design thought leaders in the world and one of the best-dressed people in the world, Ask GQ. Here's Mauro, who, by the way, has just published a new book, The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People. Here's Mauro. Mauro, welcome to the CMO podcast. I first met you, I believe, way back at 3M, probably more than 10 years ago. I came to Minneapolis on a book tour after I published my first book, and you and your colleagues hosted me, had a fabulous time. And now, 10 plus years later, you are a famous author. Congratulations on your newest book. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
First of all, thanks for having me. And you know how it feels. I mean, when you've read a book, it's like conceiving a baby. And it takes time. There are those 9 months of labor on the creation of a book. They may be longer or shorter. In my case, they were much longer. And then finally it comes to the world and you just enjoy that baby that is out there and take his own life and develop by itself. It's been magic. Beautiful, beautiful. It was my dream since I was a kid, actually, to be an author. So realize that dream was fantastic.
I wanted to be an author as well growing up. There was an editor at a magazine in New York who was my idol. And I studied writing. And then I ended up at P&G. So I don't know. That's another story.
I started my book in the same way. In the same way, I wanted to be an artist and I wanted to be an author too. I ended up becoming a designer and working in corporations.
We're going to talk about that. Well, listen, you don't have just one book out. You have 3 books that you've published recently, right? There's The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People. Good Design is for Everyone, The First 10 Years of PepsiCo Design and Innovation. And then you have a book that you've recently published in Italian. So I just want you to kind of pull back from all of that. And you said it's like having a baby. It's a beautiful thing to work on. But what have you learned about yourself in writing those 3 books? Let's start there.
Yeah, this is a question that just an author could make, because you know that the writing a book was a form of therapy. It was literally about better understanding yourself. For me, storytelling in general always played that kind of role. So even before writing book, I had always this passion of sharing the work that I was doing, sharing on in conferences, on the stage of different kind of interviews and things like this. Since I was a very, very young, I was going to university begging my teachers, from years before to give me a stage to share some of the things I was doing. It was always my passion. So when you share, when you force yourself to be a storyteller, it's very important to look back, understand what happened to you, successes, failures, and then understand how to synthesize those information in a way that is relevant to people, that can reach people and can have an impact. And so this really forces you to distill the most important messages. And that has been very useful for me over the years to understand how to be a better designer, how to be a better leader, how to grow new cultures in companies like 3M and PepsiCo from scratch. Again, learning from the past. So this is what happened also writing the book. Looking back, understanding the different interactions I was having with people, understanding what worked in those interactions to build this new design organization in PepsiCo, to achieve my dreams, to add this new layer of purpose in everything we're doing as a design organization, as a company. So all of this has been really, really powerful. But I think what I learned the most was when the book was out and I started to see the reaction of people. One of the things that I realized the most is that no matter this book was written by a designer, and design was a filter, was a lens, was a perspective and a point of view, an entry point, a lot of people fell in love with messages that had nothing to do with design and were all about people, human beings, leadership, and specifically with messages that were really, really close to my heart, but I didn't know that the masses, a lot of people would resonate with them. As an example, this idea of love, kindness, empathy, as drivers of success, as drivers of productivity, as drivers of effectiveness. You know, how many times do you hear in a boardroom of a big corporation, people talking about love and productivity combined together? So I knew that it was kind of unusual and unexpected. It was one of the messages of the book. I was positively surprised to discover that actually is one of the messages that the people love the most.
That's optimistic. You know, my book agent, when I started my first book, said, you have to write the book that only you can write. That's a high bar. In other words, you better have your own point of view. It better be something that no one else can quite write as you can. And it sounds from everything you've just said, this is definitely your book and the book that only you can write. So again, congratulations. I do have to ask you, though, before we leave this, do you have another book in your head? Do you have another idea bouncing around?
I do, and it's even essentially written. Look, I told you to write was my dream. So when I started to write, I wrote before anything else for myself, and then thinking about my kids that were not even conceived when I started, literally thinking sooner or later in the future, I will have kids, and I really want to share with them everything I've been learning. Immediately after comes new generations of, innovators and entrepreneurs and my teams as well. Those are really very important targets for me. So when I was writing for myself, I wrote a lot. At a certain point, after the equivalent of 500, 600 pages, and I was just in the middle of writing, I called my editor like, okay, here is going to be a lot of pages. What do I do? Should I stop? Should I? And they told me, look, just write and we'll help you, reducing the content and transforming it in a book. So I wrote the equivalent of 1,300 pages of a book, obviously knowing that I was never going to publish a book like this. And so essentially there are already two or three books in this. Mm. One of the topics that were not published in the first book is how to build new culture within a complex organization, within a corporation. What are the steps I went through to build all of this? And by the way, this is also something that I share with Indra Nooyi, with the former CEO of PepsiCo, when she interviewed me for the job. The five steps I went through to build the new design culture within 3M. And those are the steps that I follow up then in PepsiCo, step by step, the same playbook. This for sure is, it may be an interesting book to write about.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one.
At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com. Well, I want to hear about the five steps in a moment. And we're not going to be able to do a 1,300-page book on it, but I do want you to go through the five steps. But before we go there, you also have created a wonderful podcast series called In Your Shoes with a fantastic range of guests from business, design, culture. And I'd like you to talk a bit about that because I've listened to a few of them. I found them very compelling. What did you enjoy most about doing that show? And by the way, why did you stop?
I have this passion for sharing and storytelling. And so I was thinking, what are the platforms I can use? I'm very active in social media. I have hundreds of thousands of followers in social media, conferences, interviews, podcasts. You know, I'm a guest of podcasts, like in this case, in your podcast. But I was like, okay, maybe I could do my own podcast. But what really made me decide to do it was something that happened one day. And it was something that, you know, happened often in my life. But I remember that day, I was having a very interesting conversation with a very interesting designer. There was, at a certain point, I look at him and I tell him, look, I would love for people to listen to this. I mean, to hear what we're discussing is so inspiring for me, what you are saying. And so I started to think about all the interesting people I know that are literally friends or part of my close network. And so the idea was, I'm just going to put on stage these conversations. Why I stopped? Because I reach almost the limits of those close people in my close network that I could interview and put on stage and share this conversation in a very seamless way, you know, without too much effort, very spontaneous. Beyond that, then it becomes more of a, you know, you need to produce it, you need to, you know, to find the people, pitch the idea and everything. We may do it again in the future with other people that, you know, maybe new people that come to my life or new people I connect with.
Was there one guest? I know that every guest is special, at least in my experience, it's been that way. And I'm 5 years in the show, almost 300 guests. Everyone has been delightful. Is there one guest that you have had on your show that resonated with you personally?
They were all inspiring in different ways. One of the episodes I love the most is the one with Joe Gebbia, the co-founder of Airbnb. First of all, Joe is a designer like me. He's an industrial designer. And he ended up founding a company like Airbnb. So showing that design thinking can be applied to entrepreneurship if done in the right way. But what I really love of that is that typical of a design thinker, you know, like usually designer think, his company had a business goal, but then there was a purpose that was authentic. This guy was driven by a real purpose, really trying to help. And he built a sort of foundation. I don't remember how he called it. I mean, but he's been always driven by this idea of business and purpose together. It was literally coming from his soul. And in that interview, you can really feel it. And then the other thing is, I became, you know, over the years, a big ambassador of this idea of kindness and love. And so with Joe and a variety of other people that I know with leadership positions, I'm inviting them to share this idea of kindness, to promote this idea of kindness, to tell the world how actually kindness was a driver for them, you know, to grow and build whatever they dreamed of. Often we're told in the business world that actually you need to be the opposite. You need to be a shark. You need to be tough. You need to put people against each other to extract as much value as possible out of that competition in a Darwinian kind of way. And in reality, in this new world where you need to be hyper-efficient, where there is not margin anymore for any form of redundancy and inefficiency and ineffectiveness, kindness is a major driver of productivity because it connects people, it makes them work in a better way, in a more synergistic way. And therefore, at the end, it drives a more efficiency in the organization on top, obviously, of creating a better working environment. So the more leaders that are like this, the more these leaders promote these ideas and become ambassador of those ideas, the better it is. So Joe is a phenomenal person from that standpoint.
Yeah, I agree with that. And by the way, if you see everything they're doing, they've stayed true to that original idea and just keep making it more and more creative and interesting and compelling. So it's great to watch. I know you're very popular on Instagram. I follow you. My wife does as well. And my wife just has a question for you. She said, if you ever want to get rid of any of those jackets or coats, I would be happy to take them.
Good to know, because I have no idea where to put them anymore. I'm exploding.
Well, we've also noticed you have an adorable baby.
Yes.
And we're grandparents of a 20-month-old, so we love looking at your darling baby. I just want to ask you, as a designer, is there anything in the baby world, a product, a design, an idea that you have found just inspiring, amazing, astounding?
I was just thinking about my interaction with the world of kids and childs and children and babies. I was just waiting to become a father, because I was waiting to, you know, for all those moments in which you receive these questions and you don't know what to answer, for all that explosion of curiosity that is going to, you know, impact you. And, you know, I wanted to look at the world with the eyes of a child. I wanted to get excited like a child again, you know, and be curious and discover new things. And so I knew that it was happening. I was waiting for it. And then when it did happen, it was even better than what I was thinking. And so, you know, I have goosebumps telling you this story, because every day, and she's just 2 years old, so it's just the beginning. You know, the questions are arriving now. It's such a discovery. And I'm turning 49 this year, so I had my baby late in life. And so maybe I have less energy than if I was 30, but what I have is a lot of awareness of what a gift this baby is. I did a lot of things in life, so I enjoy spending time with her. I don't need to go party or, you know, doing other things. So I enjoy every single moment. And again, this idea of her eyes looking at the world, getting excited and being excited through her is so beautiful. It's such a joy, such a gift.
I spent this morning before our show playing with our 20-month-old grandchild who's visiting for the week, and just watching the play. It's just amazing what they play with, what they move to, what they do when they get there, what happens when they hit a problem. It's just beautiful to watch. It's hilarious. It's funny. It's charming. And it's really creative.
I've been always fascinated in this world, in the world of children, is that they're able to dream. They think big. Mm-hmm. They think without boundaries. And this is something, you know, in the book, I talk about these 24 different characteristics of these innovators, and the ability of to dream is one of them. Many people don't dream anymore in our world. You know, you dream as a child, you fantasize, and then at a certain point, society, maybe starting with your parents, tell you, well, you know, this dream is a little bit childish, it's naive, but you keep dreaming. You go to school, high school, university, you go to these companies, you arrive to P&G, to PepsiCo, to 3M, to any big corporation or small startup, and you dream. You think you can change the product, the brand, the industry. And then you meet people that tell you, that's so childish, that's so naive. Or even worse, they may tell you, this is arrogant. And so many of us stop dreaming. They think that is wrong. Dreaming is wrong. Now, society doesn't like people to dream too much. You know, if everybody would be out there dreaming, it would be a mess, right? So the idea of aligning everybody around certain kind of goals, protocols, habits, behaviors is part of, you know, how we create stability in society. So a good dose of stability is something we all love, but some space for dreaming is really, really important. So we need to learn to protect that ability to dream that we have as children and bring it to the companies, the business world, society, to our lives as well. Now, if you just dream, I say in the book, it's not enough either. You know, some people are able to dream, they keep dreaming, and they just dream, and they stay in the comfort zone of the dream. So the real innovator knows how to balance the dreaming with the action, with the execution, with making things happen fast. You know, the pace of that action is very important today. So dream, make things happen, move fast, prototype, fail, improve, get over, you know, your failures, learn out of it, and keep dreaming. The dream is important also because if you don't dream, life is difficult. You face so many roadblocks and complexities, and it's really, really tough. I always found in my dream, in my goals, energy to keep going. You know, is that where you're going? Also, where you're coming from. that, you know, I had to learn that. It didn't come spontaneous, but the ability to step back and be like, you know what, today is really, really a tough day, but look where I was 1 week ago, a month ago, 1 year ago, 10 years ago. There is progress. So appreciating the progress and thinking about the dream, the connection of the two things, so the past and the future, make you live the present in a much better way, even in days that are really, really difficult.
We've all been there. You spend millions of dollars each year driving traffic to your company's website, and then the results come in and they're just not what you hoped. On top of that, 81% of marketing leaders say website ownership is a challenge. So what do you do? Well, you switch to Webflow. Let me tell you why. Webflow's visual-first platform empowers your team to own your company's most valuable dynamic marketing asset, your website. From launching a new site to optimizing for SEO and conversions, Webflow gives you the tools you need to drive business growth fast. Unlock your website's full potential when you build, manage, and host with Webflow. Get started today at webflow.com. That's a great segue to talk about your role as chief design officer. And you're maybe the only person on this planet who's been the first chief design officer at two iconic companies, 3M and PepsiCo, and you came in as an outsider at both. And you have staying power. You stayed at 3M for 10 years. You've been at Pepsi 12 years. So you are a unique human being, Mauro, for a lot of reasons, but that's certainly one of them. So I'd like you to take us back to those early days at 3M, and by the way, also at Pepsi, coming in as the first chief design officer. You talked about your five steps a few minutes ago, but what did you do? How did you come in and start? And so reflect on those days at 3M and then fast forward to Pepsi. What did you learn from 3M that you reapplied there?
First of all, I came in with a profound knowledge of my field, design, what I was bringing in. But the second thing is be humble. I came in and I had multiple forms of respect. One, for the business community, being like, okay, this company is generating billions of dollars of sales every year, both 3M and PepsiCo. Mm-hmm. They probably do something right, even if I think through design, we could do much better, right? The five steps have been really, really important for me to understand how to move within these corporations. The very first one is what I call the denial. When the company doesn't admit that there is any kind of problem, if you stay in denial for too long, you risk to not survive.
Yeah.
Thank God, usually there are CEOs or executives in these companies. Their job is to really understand how to make the company survive. In the case of 3M, somebody at the top of the company decided to infuse design within the company. They decided to do it in a super safe way, hiring a kid, I was 27, in Italy, in the periphery of the American Empire, keeping him there for the time being, so that even if this was failing, nobody was going to even realize. And I packed my suitcases and I start to do business trips to St. Paul, Minnesota, to pitch this idea of design to the company. I think the meetings are going very well. So I remember one of the first trips, I go to the office of Dr. Monosari. You may remember Monosari was the EVP of the consumer business.
Yep.
Dr. Monosari looks at me very serious and is like, everybody is lying to you. What do you mean? No, I was there.
Minnesota nice, they call that.
Exactly. Then he told me, imagine you are in an art gallery and you are in front of a beautiful painting and you have your pocket full of money. What do you do? You buy that painting, right? Well, Mauro, you and design, you're one of the paintings in the 3M art gallery. And I know that our people are buying all other paintings and not the design painting. They're buying the next HR project, the next investment in a plant, the next branding project. So that was a major aha moment. I was living what I called later on the phase, the second phase, the phase of hidden rejection. They were rejecting me, but I had no clue that that was happening. Mm. This kind of situation happens all the time in corporations when you try to change something. You will face people that pretend to be with you and they're not. What I learned out of that conversation with Dr. Nosari is what to do when you are in these kind of situations. And it's super simple. Every time somebody tells you, I love your idea, you ask them a commitment. I call it a sacrifice. I mean, ask them something, resources. Okay, you love the idea, let's do it. Give me the money, give me the people, let's do it. And every time you ask them to, you know, to act on that excitement, the most of the times people step back and like, well, yeah, but it's not the right time, maybe next project. And that has been my mission, you know, expose the people that are not with you and find what I call the co-conspirators. And this is how you move to the third phase. I call the third phase the occasional leap of faith, when co-conspirators decide to have a leap of faith on you for a variety of different reasons. And when I joined PepsiCo, we map the co-conspirators inside the organization. On one axis, we put the projects where I could show value through design as fast as possible, the low-hanging fruits. But on the other axis, there were the leaders assigned to each project. And so we prioritized those projects where we had the right co-conspirators with the right project on. Once you work with them and you start to build your proof points, but the truth is that you can excite them for a few months, but if you don't land something concrete, you're not going to last anywhere.
Yeah.
You need to show progress. The more progress, the more people will knock your door, and you ask them resources and you build more proof points. When you have enough, a critical mass of proof points, the company realizes that it's time to move to the fourth phase. That is what I call the quest for confidence. Is when you move from startup to scale up, when you move from pioneers and pirates to processes, frameworks, ways of working, when the risks start to increase exponentially, because now you talk about big numbers and a lot of visibility. And so the key in this fourth phase is to balance that kind of intuition, emotion, or all the leadership of individuals, human centricity, with the processes and the scale. If you are successful in doing that, you move to the fifth phase. That is what I call the holistic awareness, when the company totally embraces the new culture.
I've heard you say in other venues that you always think beyond your job scope and you think about how can you help the company succeed. And those five steps are a certain part of how you do that. But I'd like you to reflect for just a moment about 3M, you were there 10 years. How do you feel you helped them succeed? And much more current, you're 12 years now at Pepsi. How do you feel you've helped Pepsi succeed?
I've been reflecting a lot about what is this thing that I call design, that we call design, and what is the real value? Especially, I needed to pitch this design thinking or design to these companies. I realized that design is nothing else than caring about humans. When you go to design school, they teach you to observe people, understand their needs and wants, and create something meaningful for them, relevant, useful, engaging. So to create some form of value for them. Then they tell you, by the way, you also need to sell this thing. So they teach you a little bit of marketing and branding, and they teach you to interact with the business world. They also tell you that you need to create this. So they teach you mathematics and physics and material science and digital technologies. These are the three lenses of design thinking. But again, designers are driven by this idea of creating value for people. So when you ask me, you know, what is the value that design brought to 3M, to PepsiCo, and can bring to any company, is actually this obsession with humans, this love for people, this love and care for the users, the customers, the consumers that we serve, and being always there, remembering other people that have other kind of backgrounds, other kind of goals that are really important for a company, to be always the balance there. Now, for that to happen, though, you need to empower these designers. Designers bring a really diverse kind of thinking to the mix, but you need to find a way to build the right balance within the company so that the different voices around the table, they have the same weight in the conversation. That's really important.
Can you talk a bit more about, I mean, this is the CMO podcast. We have listeners of all kinds, but we have many CMOs who listen. You're now at Pepsi many years. Jane Wakely is your global CMO. You've had her on your podcast. I listened to the episode. Lovely woman, by the way, smart, funny, and great in every way. Tell us a bit of how you work with her. What kinds of things do you talk about with her? What sorts of things do you work on together?
Well, so first of all, she's a great leader, a great visionary, somebody that profoundly respects design and diversity of thinking. So I love to work with her because essentially she brings to the table, obviously, a perspective that is different than mine, but she totally understands my perspective and she's ready to be surprised by my perspective. I do exactly the same with her. I respect her perspective. I'm ready to be surprised by her. And so it's beautiful how we work together, converse around different kind of problems, and we blend our visions and perspective to build something that is better than what I could do by myself and what she could do by herself. And this is really the foundation of successful innovation. You know, we look at the world all in our own ways, with our biases and experiences and backgrounds, you know, as individuals and also as professionals, obviously. Innovations happens when you look at something with the same eyes, and then one day you slightly change perspective and you see something that nobody else ever saw before. Now, for that to happen, there are multiple things that you need to do. Reading, traveling, engaging in conversations with people that think totally different from you. Even when you don't agree, talk to these people with different political views, different kind of, you know, religious views and branding and anything. You know, the more different, the better. Yeah. Engage in conversations. Maybe sometimes you will validate your point of view. You pressure test your point of view. Sometimes you will change your point of view. But the real value is when your perspective number one meets perspective number two, and through respectful dialogue, you build perspective number three that is new to the world, nobody ever had before. And so this is, you know, what I find in my conversations with Jane. We bring to the table different perspectives, we blend them together with respectful dialogue, and we create something new.
Now, for all of the senior marketing people listening who are inspired by this point in the podcast, right? They want to go back to their company and build a human-centric design as a key value and as a key capability. They want to bring kindness and love and energy and diversity to their brand, to their organization. What's your counsel to them? You've worked with a lot of great marketers and maybe not so great marketers as well, but what's one or two things they should do after this podcast if they're inspired by what they're hearing?
One thing is building organization with a human-centric kind of approach. The other one is building a human-centric kind of culture. The reason why I'm dividing them is this. I was lucky and privileged to grow in a community like the design community that makes of certain values the key characteristics, the attributes of its own leaders and designers and everything. But when I realized what were the really differentiator factors, the gift, the attributes that were really, really important, I elevated them and they realized that obviously have nothing to do just with the design community. You will find many marketers with those values and many designers that don't. So my first message is do not rely on designers to bring that kind of culture because it may come from anywhere. Make sure you're aware of what are those soft skills, those behaviors that are really, really important for your company. And make sure that, first of all, you embrace them. You need to embody them. So me writing a book like this is forcing me to be extra kind every day, extra resilient, extra optimistic, extra curious, because I need to embody that even for my own teams. Like I need to show that in an authentic kind of way, manifested in the behaviors of your team. And when it doesn't happen, you need to call it out. You need to do it all the time. And you will see that once you start to do it, first of all, you will be the ideal team. But second, and mostly, your projects will start to go in a better way, in a different way. You are going to start to avoid many of the problems you have in these kind of corporations. On the design side, you know, that I think is a very important capability for every organization, it's very important to understand how to pick the right design leader. Mm-hmm. It's not just about having a good designer. You need to have somebody that knows design inside out. And by the way, even there is product design, graphic design, digital design. And to find a designer that understands design from innovation all the way to brand design and graphic design is very rare because there is no school to prepare you for that. So, but you need that because these brands are on stage 24/7 and you need to manage every touch point of these brands and you need to think about the future of these brands. So you need that kind of expertise. Then you need designers that are also business savvy, that understand business inside out. On top of it, you need to have designers that are able to storytell and pitch the value of design. So that's a third kind of attribute. On top of it, you need to have leaders that understand how to bring others with them, inspire them, work with them, and change culture. You need change agents, culture agents. And so all of this is very important. if you want to build that kind of design capability, you need to find this kind of people, and they're not easy to find.
You have received many honors and accolades throughout your career, including GQ picked you as one of the best dressed men in Italy. Not surprised. But is there one honor that you've gotten in your career so far? You're still a young guy. That's especially meaningful to you.
You know, I'm an American citizen today, and I am grateful to America. I'm proud of being here in America, and I see my future in America. But the knightship from Italy is probably the one I'm the most proud of, given, you know, by the president of the Italian Republic. It's something, you know, I come from a super humble family, no money. I grew up with my brother and my parents all sleeping in one room in the house projects in a very difficult neighborhood of a little town 1 hour from Milan. I would have never, ever, ever, ever thought of, you know, becoming a knight of the Republic in the future, but not even of having a job like the one I'm having today. None of that. And by the way, you know, I think this is one of the biggest gifts that my parents gave me, because I think it's because of them. They grew me up with three very important values. They were all about those values. One is culture, know-how. You know, for them, having culture was very important, but it's not, they were not telling me this. They were embodying that in, you know, in the way they were thinking, studying continuously. And then they were fascinated by people, for instance, in television. They had culture. They were really good at talking. They read a lot. So culture was a pillar of the family. The second one was being a good person. For them, that translated in being Catholic. You know, they were really, you know, serious Catholic, going to mass every day. But then I realized later that what they were talking about was all about kindness and being good people. And the third one, they were following their passions. They loved what they were doing. Now, both of them were not lucky enough that their job was their passion. My mom had to work in finance. She didn't go to university. She didn't have the money to do it. She hated finance, and she left their job when she was 38 to stay close to her family, but mostly to write. She loved to write poems, books. So she's been writing all her life. My father was an artist. He studied architecture. He had the green architecture. He was not a successful architect. He was a professor in high school of technical drawings, but I remember him drawing all his life. And now they're both in their 80s, and they're still writing and drawing, you know, all the time, every day. They self-published 8 books in these years with paintings and poems. And again, why I'm mentioning this? Because they told me the importance of loving what you do. And I'm lucky because I love my job, but even if it's not your job, there is a way in your life of finding something you really love and go after the passion. And this is a message I give, especially to young people, when I talk to schools and everything, to the new generations. The most important thing in life is not money or fame, is happiness. I close my book talking about how to design happiness. There are 3 different steps, and I didn't invent anything. They come from human science. But the first one is invest in yourself. Define your identity. Who are you? So yeah, use influencers and role models and coaches and mentors to inspire you, but then mold your own identity. Understand what makes you unique. What you said earlier, Jim, you know, what is the book that just you can write? What is the job that just you can do? And so when I join all these companies, what can I bring to the table that is just me? What is the job description that I will be the best at? Not just the job description I receive. The second dimension is love. Give love to the people close to you, your family, your friends, your close community, your close colleagues. Give it in a selfless way, not to receive, but by the nature of the people around you, you will get it back. The third dimension is do something bigger than you. Transcend yourself. Have a purpose. And it can go from trying to change the world, do charity work, or, you know, something really big, all the way to small acts of kindness to strangers that you meet on the street.
What's the first brand you remember making an impact on you as a young boy growing up in this town outside Milan?
So it's interesting. You know, the very first brands I start to remember is when the fashion brands started to arrive to my town. So I remember Armani, for instance, started to arrive. I was 10, 11 years old, and wealthy people in my community started to have the Armani jeans. They were wearing jeans branded Armani. And I remember that was the first time I started to feel different, because I couldn't afford those brands.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I think of a brand, probably that's the very, very first memory. Another one that I totally, totally forgot. It was just out of my mind. And I discovered just recently, most of my notebooks at school from 6 to 13 were Pepsi branded.
Oh, my. Oh.
Geography, history, where you would write everything. I still have them. And they were Pepsi. My mother would buy them in bulk. And I totally forgot. And then I found them because, thank God, my mom conserved, you know, saved everything. And many of them were Pepsi. I was like, what a coincidence.
I love that. I thought you might say a shoe brand. I mean, you're a big shoe guy now.
I mentioned Armani, but Nike arrived as well in those periods. Yeah. Again, I couldn't afford them. And so there were this kind of fake called Soldini, an Italian brand, redoing the sushi. Or Timberland arrived. I couldn't afford them. And there was Lumberjack. There was the cheap version of Timberland. Moncler was another one back then. That was an Italian one. Yeah, some brands arrived in those periods.
Mauro, who's been the most inspiring person in your life?
For sure, my parents. I have no doubt in saying this. I owe them so much. And then there are, you know, I'm going to say something, it's going to sound weird, but the philosophers from the past, and especially Plato, Aristoteles, and Socrates, that are is the foundation of philosophy. But why? Because I studied them in high school and I keep going back to them over and over again. And I found so many answers to so many things, not just in life, but in business, in branding. This idea of love, the move the words, was in Plato, you know, at the beginning. So in general, the philosophers, because their job in thousands of years was to really understand the root causes that move everything, including business, money, everything, our lives, our love, our relationships. But those three, you know, are the foundation of everything else.
Aro, thank you for this conversation. I knew it would be wonderful. It was even better than I imagined, better than I dreamed. So thank you for this gift.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thanks for the wonderful questions and the great conversation.
That was my conversation with Mauro Porcini. Three lessons from this one for your business, brand, and life. And there was a lot here, and it was very rich. But the first one, this was a real leadership podcast. This was obviously about design as well. But it was about how to lead with kindness, with a human-centric approach to what you do, with a sense of dreaming, even when times are tough, being in touch with your organization and your colleagues. The way he talked about his relationship with the CMO of Pepsi was just beautiful. Lots and lots of leadership lessons here. Second takeaway, the keys to happiness. Mauro had a beautiful segment in here about the importance of happiness, how to achieve happiness, how he thinks about happiness. It's about investing in yourself. It's about giving love. It's about at some time in your career doing something bigger than you. So again, beautiful thoughts about happiness. And the last takeaway, and this is a bit more pragmatic, he talked about the five steps he took when he entered from the outside to Pepsi and to 3M as the first global chief design officer. And it started with curiosity, humility, and listening.
That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribed so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production.
Episodes of the CMO Podcast are produced by Gallery Media Group. The views and opinions expressed by podcast speakers and guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of our sponsors or its personnel, nor do our sponsors advocate or endorse any individuals or entities featured on the episodes.